From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. It is Friday, the first Friday, no, second Friday of July, I think. I can't remember. Anyway, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this last week. A lot to get to today, and our panel includes Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, Audrey Dutton with ProPublica, and Murphy Woodhouse with the Mountain West News Bureau. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday,
Gemma.
See, the summer's going by so fast that, it is the first Friday. July 1st happened on Saturday. This is what happens when a holiday falls in the middle of the week. All right, let's start with the 4th of July. So, Brian, the 4th of July parade was brought back this year. It had been gone for a couple of years. Tell us why there is such controversy surrounding the parade, and in particular, a group that participated.
So there's controversy over a number of groups who participated, and it's not as much about the groups themselves as the fact that they were parading with firearms, which made a number of people who attended the parade feel unsafe. I have an opinion piece that came out yesterday that says this was basically a really egregious failure by the organizers of this parade. Not necessarily the decision to include groups with views I don't agree with, but the decision to allow them to march with guns, which is a gesture of intimidation. Guns have a sensible place when you're worried about defending yourself. They have a sensible place when you're out hunting, any number of things. But if you're parading with them, if you're carrying them to a political rally or in a parade, the purpose is to intimidate people who disagree with you. And it's a real failure by the organizers of the Boise Independence Day Parade to have allowed that.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, I know in your opinion piece, you wrote that, these were these far right groups. They had AR-15s and they were, kind of smirking and sneering as they marched. And yet, they weren't going off to war. They were in a parade. And I think it's important, as you noted, that you have every right to participate in a parade, whether whether you have differing views or not. Right. It's Independence Day. That's kind of the point of it. With that said, though, this is a parade that I used to take my kids to every year when they were little. That would have been highly disconcerting to see that in a what is supposed to be or has been in the past a family friendly parade.
Yeah, that's right. That's sort of what parades are for, right? It's for kids principally. And so it's just really bizarre and a threatening gesture to be parading around with AR-15s, other weapons, many of them drawn, drawn pistols, things like that. So there's not really a good, reason to do that. The only context when I can think of as a child that someone might have been carrying a weapon, it would have been a member of a drill team of some kind. And those are dummy weapons. They're not equipped to fire.
So Brian, any word from the organizers of this event? As you said, this is, I believe, their first year organizing this parade.
They have not returned requests for comment from our reporters.
Okay. All right. Appreciate that report. Murphy, you and your Mountain West News Bureau colleague, Will Walkie, recently reported on some potential regional fallout, this coming from the U.S. Supreme Court's recent affirmative action decision. Can you talk about what Will found out during his reporting on this? And also, before you do that, kind of quickly give people an update on the decision in case folks haven't been following it.
Yeah, so among a number of pretty high profile rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court last week was a decision, basically prohibiting the use of affirmative action or race conscious admission policies. And so, what my colleague Will Walkie with the Mountain West News Bureau and over in Wyoming looked at, he looked at statements from universities across the West. What they've been saying, kind of with a handful of exceptions, is that, you know, many really don't expect to see much impact at all from the ruling. You know, many of them saying that they, you know, didn't have such policies in place to begin with. So, you know, not a whole lot of change expected there. But then, you know, those who did have, you know, some sort of affirmative action policy in place, you know, they say that they remain committed to student body diversity, and that they'll be looking for other ways to make that a reality.
Okay. Logan, can we talk a little bit about what's going on in regards to the Democrats and the Republican parties here in Idaho when it comes to what's going to happen in regards to presidential caucuses in the spring of 2024? Democrats have held caucuses before. I believe the Republicans have not. So tell us what's going on, because it looks like both will now be doing this. And do we have Logan? Logan, I don't know if you, can you unmute yourself or can you hear us?
You think we'd all have Zoom figured out by now.
You know, it's just one of those things, and it's Friday and these things happen. So you are reporting about the Democrats and the Republicans here in Idaho. They're gearing up for presidential caucuses come 2024. So tell us about that, because, and please correct me if I am wrong, but I know the Democratic Party has held presidential caucuses in the past, but the Republicans are changing everything and have not held a caucus before.
The Republicans have held caucuses in the past. Believe they did in 2012 and in 2016. But you're right. Back in 2020, both of Idaho's major parties used the state primary system and were very happy with it. You know, kind of one of the common criticisms you hear about caucuses is it's a long event that you have to come to at a specific time and participate the whole time to influence the decisions that are happening there. Whereas with a primary, mm-hmm. it's like any election, you turn in your ballot and you're good to go. As we have talked about on this show before, during the legislative session, lawmakers, in an attempt to move the date of the primary, inadvertently got rid of the primary altogether. And so kind of the story I wrote was, I keep hearing people say, including stances officially from the Republican Party of Idaho and Democratic Party of Idaho, everyone says the lawmakers should come back and do a special session and fix the primary. but everyone who said that followed it up with saying, but that's not going to happen because there's no agreement on what the special session should be about.
So then at this point, Logan, we'll end up having caucuses once again then.
Yeah. The disagreement comes down to the timing of all of this. The Republicans would love to re-establish the primary on the day in March that it was on in the past. The Democrats are fine moving it to May, like the legislature started to do during the session. And since there is no option to do a primary without action from the lawmakers, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have had to lay the groundwork to set up these caucuses so that their party members can at least have some sort of say if they can't vote on a ballot for who they would like to be their nominees for president in 2024.
Okay, well, I guess we have to be prepared for caucuses, and fingers crossed, maybe not huge lines that we've seen in the past with that.
Yes,
Audrey,
the folks...
Yeah, oh, go ahead, Logan, yeah.
Sorry, yeah, the folks I talked to, both Lauren Necochea, who's a representative in the House and the chair of the Democratic Party, as well as Senator Tammy Nichols, who's a precinct committee person over in Canyon County, they both mm-hmm. said that their parties have kind of learned some lessons from the caucuses they held in the past, and they're very mindful of the fact that the way they design it should... they're trying to make it as easy and short and simple as possible for everybody. So hopefully we don't have headaches like in the past.
Yeah, so hopefully more user-friendly. Audrey, before we get to your story, I want to say a big, huge congratulations to you on your new position with ProPublica. Can you first tell us a little bit more about the outlet and what specifically you'll be doing in your new role? And then we can talk about the news.
Thanks. Yeah, I just started last week. So ProPublica is a nonprofit, investigative-focused news outlet. It's been around for more than a decade, has produced some of you know, I think the best investigative reporting in the country. Mm-hmm. And my role is, you know, we're still kind of figuring it out. I'm hoping to do the same kinds of investigative work that I have been doing in Idaho for the Idaho Capital Sun and the Idaho Statesman. And we'll definitely be looking for folks to help us know what needs to be investigated. We have a very strong accountability focus. And I'm really excited to get started with it.
And you'll be able to stay based in Idaho, correct?
That's right. We're going to be staying in Boise. However, I will be able to report from all corners of the state.
Yeah, it's exciting. And I think it's a big deal, I think, for journalism and media here in Idaho to have you in that position. So with that said, before you left the Idaho Capital Sun, you did file one last story. This was in regards to the Idaho Health Data Exchange. So first, can you tell us what that is for folks who may not be familiar? And then from there, what we've learned, and maybe could this be an example for other states?
Yeah, so this is, I don't think many people know what the health data exchange is. Mm-hmm. We know what the health insurance exchange is, Your Health Idaho, because a lot of people purchase their health insurance through that each year. The health data exchange is sort of a medical records repository where physicians and clinics and hospitals can kind of pull up your medical record. The idea behind this is that, for example, if you usually go to a St. Alphonsus practice for your primary care here in Boise or Nampa, and you're on vacation in Salmon or Ketchum, if you were to get into a car crash and potentially end up going into the hospital unconscious, who's mm-hmm. going to tell the doctor there, the ER doctor who admits you into the ER or who takes care of you in the ER, who's going to tell that doctor what medications you're on, what previous health histories you have, if you have a heart condition? That's where a health data exchange can be really useful, because not all medical practices are on the same platforms for sharing charts. So that's kind of the basic utility of it. And it can also become more powerful when they reach kind of a critical mass of medical records, because they can start doing data analysis, like what kind of diabetes treatment is most successful if you're in a rural area, for example.
Hmm.
And Idaho's Health Data Exchange has been around for, I think, more than 15 years at this point, a really long time. And it has struggled over the years with moving away from federal funding. Almost all health data exchanges that are like Idaho's received a big boost of federal funding to get started, to kind of help them, you know, become mm-hmm. robust enough to have users or analysts or insurance companies want to pay for to use the service, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the federal funding ran out. It was scheduled to terminate, and it terminated in 2021. And the Health Data Exchange has since then kind of been wrestling with how to adjust to that, and it ended up filing for bankruptcy last year. So that's kind of what prompted our look into this.
Okay. So with that said, then, is there any way then for health professionals to track this history of patients if they are not in one system? I mean, as you mentioned, St. Al's, I'm kind of thinking about, you know, the MyChart, right? If you go anywhere within the St. Luke system, you know, that information will be in there. But let's say, as you said, you're somewhere where there isn't a St. Luke's. Well, you know,
right.
Does that mean they can't access that information anymore?
It does. Yeah. So, and this gets really into the weeds, but anybody who's gone to both St. Al's and St. Luke's probably has noticed this. St. Alphonsus moved to the same electronic medical record system that St. Luke's has been using for years. Mm-hmm. It's called Epic. So now it's a little bit easier for them to share, but you get like a small medical practice. For example, the physician that we highlighted in this story, Treasure Valley Family Medicine, it's a very small practice. And he relies on the health data exchange to get medical records. And what he says is it's not only good for, you know, finding out what my patient's health history is. It flags when they had a CT scan 10 years ago and it never got followed up on. It sends him a notification when he has a patient who's in Twin Falls on a visit, go into the hospital there, and he can call down to the emergency room and say, hey, this patient has kind of a complex history. I can help you. Let's coordinate their care once they're discharged so they don't end up with 14 days of prescription and not get an appointment with him, right? Because you need an appointment at day 13. So that's kind of the idea. But if there isn't an interlink between electronic medical records, then it's the provider having to either get the health history from the person or a spouse or family member, or request it from a healthcare provider, from the other healthcare provider, or they can use the health data exchange. So that was kind of the idea.
Okay. So now without this health data exchange, I mean, is there anything, is the state doing anything? I guess it wouldn't be the state, right? I guess it would, I mean, could, who would it be? And would we get something back like this? And what could maybe other states learn from this? I mean, I think people need to be concerned about this.
Just to kind of clarify, the health data exchange went through bankruptcy protection. And the story goes into all the nitty-gritties about why that was necessary. There was a contract dispute. There were lawsuits against the health data exchange for not paying contractors. There was a grant that was supposed to come through that didn't. The grantee says it wasn't a grant, according to an email to me. But they exited bankruptcy protection, and it just kind of allowed them to continue to operate without having their creditors filing lawsuits against them. And that's just one of the styles of bankruptcy that an organization can go through. Mm-hmm. So they have exited that. They feel like they are on better footing now. The goal is to be 100% sustainable on user fees, which is like health systems paying in to use this system, and independent providers, ambulance services, things like that. But other health data exchanges that have been successful over the past past decade, have had other streams of income coming in. So the question really is, can this health insurance or health data exchange, remain solvent and continue to grow and become useful while relying solely on private sector funding? And that's really what the question is. And so there's a question that Dr. Brian Crownover, one of the physicians I interviewed, he raised. He said, I think this needs to be publicly funded because it's a public utility. You're asking me as a primary care provider who has a really small margin to pay money to use the service that benefits everyone so much. And by putting a price tag on it, you can be preventing certain providers from joining. So it'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward in the next year, 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, absolutely. So Murphy, I want to follow up on what we discussed in the last segment in regards to the U.S. Supreme Court's affirmative action decision, in particular, having just talked with Audrey here about this health data exchange keeping with the health aspect. You spoke with the head of one of our region's handful of medical schools about the U.S. Supreme Court's affirmative action decision. What did he tell you?
Yeah, so I was able to speak with Dr. Mark Kahn, and he is the dean of the Kirk Kerkorian School of Medicine, which is a relatively new program at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And I do want to say that, you know, he graciously gave me a fair amount of time and the day before 4th of July, when it's often extremely difficult to get anyone on the phone, let alone, you know, the head of a medical school. So thanks to him. But yeah, so he told me that his program had never really used sort of a formal point system for affirmative action. And he says he doesn't really expect much appreciable impact from the ruling, but he used just really strong language to talk about the importance of ensuring diversity among medical school students. And, you know, we've seen lots of statements about, you know, from universities in the wake of this ruling about, you know, being committed to diversity, fairness, righting past wrongs, that sort of thing. But what I heard from Kahn and read in statements and amicus briefs, et cetera, from medical educators is that physician diversity is key to ensuring good health outcomes. So, you know, given widespread disparities in access and health outcomes between ethnic groups and, you know, urban and rural, lots of different sorts of divides, he called making sure that medical school students reflect the communities they'll be serving a moral imperative. And then I'd also like to just briefly read from the amicus brief that was filed by the American Association of Medical Colleges and co-signed with numerous major national medical organizations. They wrote, quote, "Diversity in the education of the nation's physicians and other healthcare professionals is a medical imperative. As an overwhelming body of scientific research compiled over decades confirms, diversity literally saves lives by ensuring that the nation's increasingly diverse population will be served by healthcare professionals competent to meet its needs." And so Dr. Kahn told me that medical schools are just going to have to find other ways to make sure that their classes reflect their communities. In the wake of the ruling, some medical educators have expressed hope that the ruling's apparent openness to so-called holistic review that sort of leaves room for consideration of applicants' life experiences and even racial background. And Kahn says that his school takes into consideration socioeconomic background and applicants' service work and commitment to their communities. They also look at what he calls the journey that they've taken to applying for med school. He says that people who have overcome adversity can make for better med school students. And so really the impression that I was left with, both from his comments and what I saw from other medical schools, was that there appears to be a will to continue to prioritize medical diversity in the wake of this ruling, and still some ways to go about working towards it.
Well, and it is important to be discussing this, Murphy, because, you know, all we have to look at is you know, maternal death rates. And the United States has one of the worst in the world. Frankly, we have the we have the worst in the developed world, right? But then you look at African American mothers here in the United States, and their maternal death rate is exponentially higher than white women. And when we do know that when they have medical professionals who are of the same race and background, we see those numbers start to drop. And that goes down to lived experience, right? So did that come up at all? And did he give any examples? Or was it just that, as you said, they're aware of this and they know the importance of having this diversity?
Yeah, I mean, he didn't necessarily go into a lot of like specific examples of how of how this would play out. But I was just really struck by just the, I guess, the conviction, both in what he was saying and what I was saying, what I was hearing from other organizations. I mean, I certainly couldn't speak to, you know, the nature of the research underpinning all of this, but certainly, you know, major respected national medical organizations are really seeming to speak with a single strong voice on this, that, you know, that there are just like real health consequences, serious health consequences, you know, when the physician population does not reflect the population they're serving. And then I think it's also worth saying that Dr. Kahn did, you know, talk about like diversity in a lot of different sorts of senses, certainly racial diversity, ethnic diversity, but also like people who are familiar with life in rural places, you know, kind of like rural urban divides, like, you know, coming from poorer backgrounds, et cetera. Like there are lots of different sorts of background experiences that I think are important to prepare physicians for serving the many different sorts of people who are in their communities.
Well, so glad you were able to talk with him, as you said, especially the day before the 4th of July. So, Brian, some interesting and some would say concerning happenings going on the education front in North Idaho. Can you tell us about how a person was hired to be the superintendent of a fairly large school district up north? really without any type of educational experience.
Right. So we're talking about Brandon Durst. We've spoken about him before. He's I describe him as a serial political entrepreneur. He was first a Democrat in the Idaho legislature in both the House and then the Senate. Then he went to Washington, attempted run for office, attempted run for several offices in Idaho when he came back, now as a Republican. Now he has just been appointed by a school board there that has been taken over by the far right to be the superintendent of the school district. So that's sort of the chief executive position of the district. This is over the objections of a wide variety of parents, including some pretty conservative parents up there, who are very concerned that he has not worked in the school district before. The main other competitor for the job, the interim superintendent, has been the teacher of the year, longtime school teacher, principal, and had been the acting superintendent. The board actually had to declare a state of emergency in order to hire him. So they did that when they hired him recently.
Okay, go back to that. They declared a state of emergency so they could hire him. How does that even work?
The district is able to declare a state of emergency just by passing a resolution, as other government entities are able to do. The reason for this is that he didn't have the necessary state qualifications to serve as a superintendent. So he's having to apply for those on an emergency basis. So for him to be hired, they had to declare a state of emergency. This is sort of a bit of irony given the far right's attitude towards states of emergencies during the COVID-19 pandemic, which has killed something like 7 million people worldwide, probably more than that, but that's the number that's out there right now. You know, there was intense opposition to any kind of state of emergency for that. But it was, you know, when it comes to giving a political ally a job, there seemed to be a sufficient basis to declare an emergency in this case.
Here's what's interesting with this story, though. I mean, it's so very interesting in many regards. But Brian, I think it's, you know, parents who are vehemently opposed to this appointment. And these are not parents who bend liberal, right? I have seen videos posted on social media of parents. They have personally gone up to Brandon Durst and they are questioning him and they are not happy about this. And these are not necessarily, as I said, you know, parents who would normally say, you know what, we want more conservative values in schools, but yet they are really unhappy with this appointment. And do we know, you know, why we're kind of seeing that push and pull?
Well, so that's the answer to that question involves what's going on in many different people's heads. So it's hard to say for sure, but my intuition is that a lot of these parents, even if they're conservative, what they really care about when it comes to their children's education is that they get a good education, not that they are presented some particular worldview. I think there are indications that's really the driving interest. I mean, we've seen it in the far right takeover of North Idaho College. You know, there's both an effort to dethrone people who are dedicated to diversity and things like that, and the educational system is at serious risk. I mean, they could get lose their accreditation any day now. Not saying that's certain to happen, but it's a real threat that was not present before the far right takeover. So I think that's what a lot of these parents are seeing. They don't consider schools to be primarily political. They consider them to be educational institutions, and they would like educators to run them.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, you reported in your opinion piece as well that this is not unique to Idaho. I mean, we are seeing this happen in other parts of the country as well, to really go to a much more, you know, conservative ideology within the public school system.
Yeah, that's right. So a prominent example has recently taken place in Florida, a college called the New School of Florida. And a takeover there was orchestrated by Governor Ron DeSantis, who replaced most of the trustees there. And one of the things they did very quickly, just like the hiring of Durst, is they hired a new college president. That college president, like Durst, is primarily a politician. He was the Florida Republican House Speaker. And he got a very sweetheart contract. He's going to make a salary of about $700,000, which is about $400,000 more than his predecessor. And so that's an interesting pattern that you're starting to see across the board in these cases, is that not only is there an effort at a kind of ideological takeover, but it's accompanied by corruption of various kinds. It's very hard to see why the former Florida House Speaker would do a better job running a college than the existing college president, much less so much better a job that he would be paid more than double. But that's what's happening.
All right. Let's switch gears here. And Murphy, what is going on with federal wildland firefighters? Because they are facing some really dire consequences. So can you remind us what the basic situation is that they're facing?
So relatively low pay has been a very long standing issue among federal wildland firefighters. And then in late 2021, the bipartisan infrastructure law, a major, massive piece of legislation that included funding for temporary raises for those federal firefighters. And we're talking very big jumps. That was either 50% of base pay or $20,000. So real serious cash. But that money, it runs out at the end of September. And as some in the fire world are calling that, the firefighter fiscal cliff. And, you know, when I learned about this, I put myself back in my old fire boots. September is a very, very hard month in fire. You've got most of a season under your belt. You're mentally exhausted. You're physically exhausted. And just, you know, imagining having my pay cut substantially at the end of one of the season's toughest months, it's not super difficult to make sense of the anger and frustration that's out there. And many, many are warning of a mass exodus from the federal fire force if the issue is not addressed in time. And as I previously reported, there are better opportunities out there for folks, not just outside of fire, but state and private agencies, in many cases, do pay substantially more than federal agencies.
Okay. So, Murphy, what is now going on? Because what thousands of firefighters are putting the pressure on, right, for something to happen?
Yeah. So last week, a group called Grassroots Wildland Firefighters, they're an advocacy group that's been pushing for a number of workplace reforms in recent years. They got a petition going, and it has really gotten traction pretty quickly. So I think it ended the week at like well over 7,000-8,000. Can't remember exactly, but checked in with Grassroots' Reva Duncan this morning, and they're getting pretty close to 10,000 signatures in basically just a week, a little over a week. And what they're asking for is pretty simple, that Congress quickly pass a permanent pay solution. And as I previously reported, there are a handful of possible ways to go about doing that. That could be TIMS Act, which would deal with the pay issue along with a number of other reforms that firefighters have been demanding. Or it could be President Biden's proposed budget, which also includes permanent raises. Grassroots and others are sort of agnostic about which solution, but they are definitely not agnostic about the importance of getting it resolved somehow and pretty quickly. And Reva made the point to me that, you know, the money runs out at the end of September, but a solution needs time for implementation. It's not like they can wait till like September 29th or 30th to make this happen. So, you know, while the cliff is just under 3 months away, a solution, the deadline for a possible solution to you know, avoid disruption in pay, it has to happen sooner than that.
So, Murphy, when we talk about, you know, a significant cut in pay, what do we know? I mean, what does that look like? Is it a 30% cut, 50% cut? What would that potentially be?
Well, I'm not going to try to do math live on the radio,
okay.
but yeah, that the 50% increase in base pay would go away. Different people got different sorts of raises, so it'll be different for different people. But I mean, we're talking about substantial double digit immediate declines in pay while you're still doing the same work. And again, as I mentioned before, in a month when a pay cut is not going to taste very good.
Well, and not just that, Murphy, right? I mean, that type of pay cut would just be, I mean, shocking and potentially life-changing for so many people. But with that said, I mean, these are firefighters who literally put their lives on the line, right? And fire season doesn't end in September. I mean, a lot of times here in the West in particular, you know, we have fires that go on into October even. So, I mean, if they literally leave, right, we're talking tens of thousands of firefighters potentially just walking off the job. I mean, that's dire. That could be dire consequences for all of us living in the West.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what would happen. If there weren't to be a solution. But I think that, all work is challenging to some degree. And I think all of us can imagine what it would feel like to be doing the same thing, to be putting in the same hours and to suddenly be getting paid a whole lot less for it and to be expected to continue showing up. And, you know, the Federal Firefighting Force isn't the whole wildland fire force, mm-hmm. but it's a big part of it. I think it's something like 18,000-19,000 of the people that we put out there every single year. And as you rightly mentioned, many of them are, it's a dangerous job. And in the comments that I've seen from those who have signed this petition, I mean, that is a refrain. Like, we are doing extremely dangerous work. We're working extremely long hours and our pay is about to get cut unless action is taken. So I think it's an issue that I think a lot of people can sympathize with the situation faced by the thousands of young women and men out there this summer right now as we speak.
So as of today, then, Murphy, we know this petition is being signed, but do we know of any movement then by Congress to do anything about this?
So I haven't heard any recent updates, but I, a couple of weeks back, I did get the chance to speak with Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado, who's the Senate sponsor of a bicameral piece of legislation, Tim's Act, that I mentioned before. Back then, he was pretty hopeful that there was bipartisan support. But, the message I was getting from Reva Duncan with Grassroots Wildland Fire is like, yeah, we got options on the table. We hear that there's movement and support, but like, we're not seeing action. So, I mean, there's still time left, but as she and others have made clear, like, not the full 3 months. This is the time to do it.
So Logan, some new laws took effect here in Idaho on July 1st. Now, one had to do with voter registration, but it seems to be causing a lot of confusion. Can you talk to us about this? Because my understanding is that there have been some organizations who register people to vote, have suspended that, but they're now suing over this. Can you hear me, Logan? I think we have more technical issues.
Check, 1, 2, 3.
Oh, is that you, Logan? Can you hear us?
I didn't change any settings. I don't know what happened.
Logan, that's what I just said, though. It's just there's something in the, it's like there's little gremlins in the air or something. Something's going on. All right. With that said, talk to us about this new law that took effect on July 1 in regards to voter registration, because it's really causing quite a bit of confusion, in particular with these organizations who register folks to vote.
Sure. Like any year, a number of the laws that the legislature passed took effect on July 1st. That's generally the start of the new fiscal year for the state. And so that's kind of the default date. And listeners may recall that the legislature made moves to remove student IDs from the list of identification you could use to register to vote. And they also kind of standardized how you prove your residency here in Idaho to be able to vote. Leading up to July 1st, there's a lot of different ways you can register. You could register in person at the polls, in person at the county clerk's office, via the mail, via a website. And so Secretary of State Phil McGrane noted that those different methods kind of had different standards, none of which exactly lined up with what you actually needed to vote.
And so the legislation was all, as a package, was supposed to kind of standardize, you know, the documents that you can use. We heard anecdotes during the legislative session of, you know, University of Idaho students using a delivery from Amazon to their apartment to prove their address for voting purposes in Moscow. And so now in state law, there is a specific list of documents you can use to prove residency. But the issue for these organizations has arose because it used to be for them, they would do a voter drive and collect these voter registration cards, and submitting the card was pretty much the only requirement. As long as the information was good, the county clerks would register folks and they're registered to vote. Now you need to prove your residency regardless of which form you use to register. And so the issue these organizations are running into, the League of Women Voters of Idaho and Babe Vote, is if they submit these cards, the registration is incomplete until the voter proves that they are actually a resident of Idaho and they live where they say they live.
Okay, so so Babe Vote and the League of Women Voters have suspended their registration drives right now, correct?
Yes, that's right. The League suspended theirs entirely because they said they had too many questions, and they really value education and getting voters accurate information. And they said they couldn't do that because they had too many questions. Babe Vote went ahead and tried to keep registering people. Specifically, they were at the Riverfest 4th of July celebration in Idaho Falls, and between the Secretary of State's website being down as they're making adjustments to implement this legislation, and voters being frustrated that they would have to go to a county clerk's office eventually to confirm their registration, they said it just wasn't worth the effort to try for, you know, how little they got out of it. So the League and Babe Vote have filed an injunction to try and stop enforcement of this law while there is some other legal action going on regarding the student IDs issue that I referenced before.
So now we're just waiting to find out what happens then within a court of law in regards to this new law.
Yeah, that's right. The Secretary of State's online voter registration tool is supposed to be back up, I believe, on Monday or Tuesday of next week. We will check on that. And they're just implementing that. So if you use your driver's license to register, they can verify your address on the back end with the transportation department is why that's offline at the moment.
Okay. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining us today and getting us up to date. Quite a bit of news happening this last week. A big thank you to Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman Opinion Reporter, Logan Finney with Idaho Public Television, Audrey Dutton with ProPublica, and Murphy Woodhouse with the Mountain West News Bureau. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.